17th of June 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions: is there a dress code for a slut walk? Will the backlash against the new College of the Humanities continue, or will we finally cut the rich, privileged ruling classes some slack? If the government makes a U-turn, should we applaud them or complain about their dangerous driving? Are the people coming over here and taking our jobs actually real, or do they exist only in the minds of the Daily Express? And did Harold Camping deceive his followers who believed the rapture was imminent, or was he just as crackers as they were? But first, how do you find a fossil in a haystack? Exciting news this week as scientists have found a 750-million-year-old fossil. Presumably, it's Nick Clegg's vestigial backbone. The fossils are thought to be the earliest example of biomineralisation, but here's the thing, it's only 20 microns across. It's a good job Jurassic Park used bigger dinosaurs, otherwise it'd be shit. But to find out more, Liz Luckendorf has been speaking to the woman who found them.
You may have caught a news article this week announcing the discovery of the oldest armoured fossil. The news is based off a paper in the journal Geology called Phosphate Biomineralization in Mid-Neoproterozoic Protists. One of the main authors of the paper is Phoebe Cohen, who studied these tiny fossils for her PhD at Harvard. She is now a postdoctoral associate in the MIT Department of Earth, Atmospheric and Planetary Sciences and the Education and Public Outreach Lead for the NASA Astrobiology MIT team, The Advent of Complex Life. What Cohen, her co-author Frances McDonald, and the research team discovered was the earliest evidence of biomineralization in fossils found in rocks from the Yukon Territory in Canada. This pushed the date of biomineralization in fossils back 200 to 250 million years, as these microfossils are dated between 700 and 800 million years old. I was able to grab a quick interview with Phoebe Cohen about her research into these tiny organisms and the implication of the discovery in this area. The call was done via Skype to her satellite phone in Shark Bay, Australia, so the sound may be slightly fuzzy in some places.
So our paper was about some single-celled microfossils, and these single-celled fossils were found on the Alaska-Yukon border. And we believe that they represent the first time in Earth history that a living organism made a hard part out of a mineral. And that's a process called biomineralization. So these fossils are important because they give us a window into how this very important process first started in Earth history.
Did you think you'd find such fossils in the rocks you looked at? And what previous research led you to look there in the first place?
So the fossils had actually first been discovered by a group of researchers from the University of Alaska in the early 1980s. But the fossils had only been found in a type of rock called a chert, which is basically a rock that's like glass. And so the fossils were basically entombed in this glass. And so it was hard to study them, and they couldn't figure out what they were made out of, which meant that they couldn't tell if they were actually biomineralized or not. They also couldn't figure out just how old the rocks were that the fossils were found in. So it was a sort of intriguing mystery in our field. As a graduate student, I teamed up with a fellow graduate student of mine, Frances McDonald, who's a geologist, and we decided to go back and resample that location where the fossils had originally been found.
The first thing that struck me when I was reading about this was the pictures that you took of these tiny microorganisms. How did you manage to take such amazing photos of these fossils?
The photos of the fossils in the paper, many of them were taken with a scanning electron microscope. And so one of the discoveries that we made in this paper was that not only were the fossils being preserved in this glass-like rock called chert, they were also being preserved in carbonate, which is basically a rock that you can think of like chalk. And so it's very easy to dissolve. So we dissolved these carbonate rocks in a very weak acid and discovered that the fossils were also being preserved in these carbonate rocks. And so instead of looking at the fossils through sort of a pane of glass, we were able to take them out of the rock entirely, place them under an electron microscope, and take those absolutely fabulous pictures. And it turns out that there's all of this intricate detail in these fossils that we just couldn't see using other techniques.
So these aren't the oldest fossils that we know of, but the earliest fossils that involved bimineral structures. How many different types of fossils did you find, and were there lots of examples?
I dissolved maybe 60 chunks of rock from this area, and only 6 of those chunks had fossils in them. Of those 6 chunks that had fossils in them, the fossils were very abundant. So very, very common in the specific piece of rock. And that probably has to do with just the environment when the rock was deposited and, you know, probably the life cycle of these organisms while they were living. So when we found them, they were quite abundant.
I think you also mentioned, or has been mentioned in some of the news articles, that these are essentially defending against predators. Do we know the earliest evolution of biomineralization in predators, and how do you tell the difference between, you know, predator and prey when they're that small?
That's a great question. You can't tell the difference. And so that's a hypothesis. So our hypothesis is we say, you know, look at these organisms are expending time, energy, and resources to make these really intricate structures. And why would an organism do that? Paleontologists are also evolutionary biologists, so we have to think about it in evolutionary terms. Why would it be advantageous for a critter to make a hard part? And the most obvious answer is to prevent it from being eaten by another critter. So that's one of the reasons why these organisms made a hard part. It's probably not the only reason, because like most things in biology, there's usually multiple reasons, multiple functions for a trait that's found in an organism. It's not just one function.
Okay. And what are the implications for what we know about life in this period, or indeed the evolution of biomineral structures?
Well, I think interesting implications is that it means that the ecology of life was changing. And by the ecology of life, I mean the way that organisms were interacting with each other. If during this time period, we know that there are many other fossil groups that appear in sort of a similar time period, this is about 750 million years ago, and it sort of implies a diversification of single-celled life in the oceans. We know from studying more recent fossils and from studying animals in the modern, predation can increase diversity. And this is relatively well documented in animals, but the evidence of biomineralization in these fossils from the Yukon suggests that perhaps something similar was starting to happen in the world's oceans with single-celled organisms 750 million years ago. And that leads us to think about how the relationship between organisms and their environment and each other were changing, and those changes could lead to increased diversification. And that increased diversification could in turn lead to the major changes that we see happening after this time period in the Cambrian radiation. And the Cambrian radiation is not only just a radiation of animals, but also of other plants and potentially algae as well. So these fossils don't have a direct bearing on the Cambrian radiation, but they give us a much better insight into what was happening before this time period. We know that all of the incredible diversity and complex ecosystems that we see after the Cambrian couldn't have come from zero.
And you're in Perth right now, or near Perth. What are you working at? What are you looking for out there?
So I'm actually about 10 hours north of Perth in near Shark Bay. And Shark Bay is a closed bay in Western Australia that is home to structures called stromatolites. And stromatolites are mounds made by microbes, made by bacteria, mainly by cyanobacteria, bacteria that photosynthesize. And these mounds sort of look like maybe a reef, except it's not made of corals, made of bacteria and carbonate. And these stromatolites, a billion, 2 billion years in the past, were extremely abundant. In fact, they're some of our best evidence of early life on Earth and our best evidence of the evolution of photosynthesis on Earth are these fossilized stromatolites. And they really only exist in a very few places today, and one of those places is Shark Bay. And the reason is that if you're a snail, a microbial mat is like a buffet to you. You just eat it right up. But Shark Bay is enclosed, and so it's very, very salty because there's so much evaporation and not as much precipitation. And so animals like snails that graze on microbial mats don't like living in Shark Bay. And so they're just not there. And so the microbial mats and the stromatolites can grow undisturbed. And so I'm here as part of a big, huge collaborative team of people from all over the world. And some of us are studying the communities, the microbes that make up these mats, trying to understand them and we can interpret the ancient ones better. And then we're also working on an educational product in the U.S. That I'm a part of. And so that's going to be really fun, and it'll be freely available to the public, hopefully in about a year from now, so that people all over the world can virtually explore this area and see these incredible structures for themselves.
There is a longer version of this interview, which you can find at poddelusion.co.uk. I encourage you to listen to the longer version as well, as it's all incredibly interesting. Either that, or I just like hearing about microorganisms and electron microscopes. If you'd like to find out more about this topic, you'll have to get access to the journal Geology and have a go. We've also linked to the Wired article, where you can see some of the amazing detailed electron microscope images of the fossils that Cohen and her associates revealed. This has been Liz Lusendorf for The Podlusion.
Now, last weekend, there was a big anti-rape march in London, known as Slut Walk. Whilst there were no counter-pro-rape protests, it did happen to take place on the same day as the World Naked Bike Ride. Presumably, the cyclists must have thought the thousands of women in attendance dressed as sluts looked a bit uptight and conservative by comparison. But nevertheless, it sounds as though it was a good event for a good cause. Rumour has it that Ken Clark was asked to attend, but he was more interested in good old-fashioned classic rape, and he thought that these days it's just too commercial. Christine Ottery was on the march and sends us this report on what happened.
It all started with a Toronto cop who remarked that if women wanted to avoid being victimised, they should stop dressing like sluts. In protest, women have been marching on slut walks. It started in Toronto, spread to the US, Australia and now the UK. Future slut walks will even take place in Kyrgyzstan, South Africa and India. Slut walks are becoming a global phenomenon and a controversial one. Some feminists argue that we shouldn't be reclaiming the word slut. But the fact remains that slut walks have energised a new generation of feminists in a way that no other recent movement has. So I joined around 5,000 people, mostly young women, in London to walk for the right to wear what we want without the fear of sexual attack. We're marching from the top of Piccadilly to Trafalgar Square. On the way, I asked some of the protesters, what are their reasons for slut walking today?
Today I'm marching because I think it's really, really important that we end blame culture. With no other crime would the victim be scrutinised so much, and I just think that's totally unacceptable. It's always the rapist's fault, never the victim.
I think for too long people have put the blame for rape on the victim rather than the aggressor. And also, I think if a man is raped, he would never be questioned as to why he was in that area at night, what he was wearing. Whereas women, that's the first thing that's questioned, and I just think it's time to end that now.
I was raped at 14, I was abducted at 19, and I've just been through breast cancer. And last year when I was on drugs from the hospital, prescribed ones, I got accosted at a bus stop by an 18-year-old youth, and yet I felt totally harassed by police. I'm here because it is so wonderful to be surrounded by women and men who really believe that it's time for change.
I'm an independent sexual violence advisor, so I work with victims of rape every day. We're here because we need to raise awareness of some of the issues of rape. It's still massively underreported, and men still have no idea what no means a lot of the time, and somebody's been raped, it impacts on their lives forever.
I'm here less because of the word slut and more because of rape. I think that attention should be turned away from the women and towards the rapists. And I'm here in support also of my sister who was raped.
Hey, it's my sister! Get your hands off my sister!
People are watching on aghast or clapping us on as the slut walk march comes past. People are dressed up in corsets with lipstick slogans on their chests, including some of the guys. But there are also many of us dressed in jeans or shorts because women can get raped no matter what they're wearing, and their attacker is likely to be someone they know. There are some brilliant placards people have made. My favourites are "My dress is not a yes" and "Cleavage is not consent." The vibe is defiant and positive as ordinary women stand up for the right not to be raped, and we enter Trafalgar Square for the rally. Slut Walk London was organised by the 17-year-old sixth former Anastasia Richardson. Here are some words from her.
Enough of somehow being framed and being held liable on our own sexual assault. We're saying that it's not her fault. Not if she was naked, not if she was drunk, not if she was your girlfriend, not if he was your boyfriend or husband. We're saying that wherever we go, whoever we are and however we dress, no will always mean no, and there is never any excuse for sexual assault. In a country where only 6.5% of rape cases end in conviction, 95% of rape cases never even make it to the police in the first place. We've had enough of governments that say we have our best interests at heart, and yet cut funding to rape crisis centres, women's services. Governments claiming that not all rape is serious. He refused to make the distinction that some women, some people, are somehow more worth protecting than others. Women of colour, transgender women, disabled women, sex workers, people of all genders and sexualities are part of this movement. Because we recognise that sexual assault will never be eradicated until asylum seekers can report crimes to the police without fear of deportation. Children taken away from them by social services. Until transgender women can report rape without their status as a real woman somehow being called into question. And until black women can report rape without fear of being disbelieved because of the colour of their skin.
Sluts are made for walking, and that's just what we'll do. One of these days these sluts are gonna walk all over you.
The news broke yesterday evening that Professor A.C. Grayling will not be taking up the post of President of the British Humanist Association. This came as a surprise, as this weekend he was officially due to take over as president from Polly Toynbee, who is now staying on until a new president can be found. He's resigned, or pre-signed, if you will, because of the ongoing controversy over the new College of the Humanities, the elitist private college that will charge $18,000 a year, of which he will be the master of. Personally, if I were starting an institution which has received such negative publicity, I wouldn't give myself such a sinister-sounding title. But there you go. You might remember that on last week's programme, episode 88, we had an exclusive audio clip of Professor Richard Dawkins defending his role as a lecturer and shareholder in the new college. To cut a long story short, he argued that the NTH, being so expensive, was only like how rich people can afford to buy expensive cars. So that makes it all fine. Sometimes I wish I had a car, because having to take the bus doesn't seem to give me privileged access to an old boys network, which will help me get to these higher echelons in society. Alas, my bus will only help me get to Peckham bus station. But is the NCH such a bad idea? We've now got a couple of reports and we're going to face them off against each other. So first up, here's James Firth, who will be arguing that the NCH is actually a good thing.
It's hard to find an activist blog that doesn't at some point criticise state control. We are already living in a police state. Protest and dissent is being crushed by the government in order to force through their drastic public spending cuts. The last two quotes were taken from the same discussion forum, by the same poster. Another video, posted by a UK Uncut sympathiser, bears the title, UK Establishment Using Police State to Crush Resistance. The irony is that cuts will lead to a smaller state, with less money to spend on services like the police and security forces. With less money to spend, there will inevitably be less intrusion, less chance of a real police state emerging because of a limit to money and resources at the government's disposal. One UK Uncut poster accused his own university of being an arm of the government after the university took out a High Court injunction in a bid to block sit-in protests over planned cuts. It's an unfortunate side effect of a public education system that it ultimately does fall under state control. So enter Anthony Grayling and his plans to offer private university education. Taking no government funding means far fewer strings to force the institution to comply with the wishes of the state. A wholly private funding arrangement will also allow the new College for the Humanities to experiment with teaching methods without having to justify its arrangements to government. No pesky, "University wastes hundreds of thousands of pounds on star teachers," uncovered by Freedom of Information requests. On one hand, New College could be seen as a despicable, elitist development and having a hugely negative impact on social mobility. But thousands of wealthy UK parents already send their offspring to private universities abroad. Another concern voiced over private universities in the UK is that it will skew the salary scale for good teaching staff, tempting the best teachers away from public institutions. But again, this is already happening to a reasonable degree already. Scottish-born Professor James Boyle, known as a founding member of Creative Commons and a world-leading expert on digital copyright, contributed to the Hargreaves Review of Copyright by the UK government, but he teaches at Duke in North Carolina. Tim Berners-Lee teaches at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Simon Sharma is based at Columbia. Linda Colley at Princeton. The list goes on. Essentially, people are rightly concerned that private universities might put a high-quality education beyond the reach of ordinary students. But such institutions might have a different effect. They may harness private capital to invest in better educational methods. They may stop UK academic talent from emigrating, and at least being on hand in the country to increase their probability of participation in UK-based conferences, etc. They may prevent wealthy UK families sending their children abroad and the fees paid contributing to the UK economy. If new private universities do none of these things, then they're nothing more than a distraction, an irrelevance allowing the wealthy but not so bright a chance to experience university life. We already have private schools, so what's the point in protesting against private universities? In fact, I have a greater philosophical aversion to private schools than private universities, simply because schooling occurs at a time when a child is wholly dependent on its parents, and so is disadvantaged solely on his or her parents' ability to pay. By the time a child reaches university age, there is at least the possibility of private sponsorships based on academic ability, possibly linked to a future employer. There's also the small chance a young adult has made a fortune in their own right by the time they attend university, through a combination of child stardom or entrepreneurial brilliance. Of course, corporate sponsorship has its own critics. Whether universities becoming arms of corporations is any better than being an arm of government, I guess, depends on your political philosophy and view of corporations, as powers competing with states, therefore keeping the power of the state in check, or powers in legion with states and therefore simply extensions of government control. In reality, it's probably a bit of both. Governments rely on the products of private corporations, not just the physical products, but also the power and control structures of corporations to divvy up the spoils amongst its workforce and keep the population productive. But corporations are a series of autonomous decentralized power bases themselves competing with each other and keeping pressure on the state to accommodate their needs. If these private universities do well, then they will, in all likelihood, drive standards in public institutions. Public universities will be able to adopt the successful innovations made by private institutions and reject the less successful experiments in teaching methods. For those worrying that this is the first step towards privatising all universities, to that I'd say, where's the evidence? I wouldn't be so optimistic if we were talking about the eradication of the last remaining public universities, but we're not. We're talking about one new institution. On a whole, the UK state school system, despite its faults, hasn't fallen massively behind private education. Fair enough, I failed my own Oxford interview, but that was probably due to my lack of preparation, despite my school's support, rather than the fact I had a state education. Questions of elitism and social mobility are entirely valid, but they must be viewed in context with many other factors. If all the energy thrown into opposing private universities was instead directed at ensuring public institutions remained competitive in offering equivalent standards of education, it would raise the bar for everyone. But arguing against the creation of one private university, whose success is yet to be established, just because of an ideological opposition on grounds of elitism, doesn't strike me as entirely rational. This is James Firth reporting for The Pod Delusion.
And now, here's a report by Misty, who will be arguing exactly the opposite.
I'm confused. How come Pod Delusion contributors and listeners can be berating the sellout by Lib Dems over tuition fees 1 minute and trying to defend Grayling and the new College of the Humanities the next? All those wanting to look to see whether the cost for the NCH is justifiable are completely missing the point. If they follow this argument through, they'll end up making Thatcher look like a liberal lefty, charge the actual cost and let the market decide. What is the cost of the special schools per student? Some of those children will never walk or talk, let alone complete a GCSE, and as for an elite university education. The cost per student at a special school would make the NCH look like netto. No, the fine detail costings are a red herring and one of many avoidance strategies employed by those in an attempt to avoid facing the truth. Privatising university education is wrong. Charging tuition fees is wrong. And the fact that it is reality doesn't make the private university less wrong. I've heard all sorts of arguments over the last week. Such as, there's nothing wrong with an elite education. We need to educate our brightest. And, the market will decide if it sinks or swims. And, well, it's no different to the system in the States. And, it is only the cost of such a, true cost of such an education. And, the system has changed. I like it no more than you do, but there it is, face it. So we might as well just knuckle down and get on with it. And, so it goes on. Look, we've devalued university education through the expectation of everyone going to university. Trades are no longer seen as having any status. You need at least a diploma in regulation enforcement law before becoming a traffic warden, and a Bachelor of Science in Electronic Engineering before becoming a beautician specialising in the hirsute. The nation balked at the 9,000 tuition fee limit, but we were assured it would be the absolute exception for the most costly creme de la creme courses. However, as has been widely reported, the average tuition fee will be £8,765. Remember, average. And as the maximum is £9,000 a year, fears grow that if you are not charging the £9,000 or something near it, then you will be seen as somehow inferior. Now the new kids on the block, or the NCH, are charging twice that at £18,000 a year. How long will it be before the maximum fee is raised for all universities? But my real issue is how some people cannot bring themselves to come out and say, this is not on. I didn't have to pay for my education, nor did those who introduced tuition fees, nor those setting up the new College of the Humanities. You are out of order. Instead, over the past 10 days, all we've had are convoluted arguments as to why it's not wrong. Dawkins himself at the recent BHA event came out with a whiny, well, if you can't beat them, join them, justification. These agonised, twisted arguments remind me of theists backed into a corner. The God works in mysterious ways argument, or an early and painful death of a young person is God testing our faith. And faith without evidence is stronger than a belief with evidence, doublespeak in a desperate attempt to fool themselves. I feel like that at the moment, listening to other people around me. A.C. Grayling, long held in high esteem by atheists and humanists, likewise for Dawkins, people cannot seem to accept that such esteemed figures should ever be criticised. Look, I love Dawkins' science writing and his pretty dealings with religious folk, but I'm able to say when I think he is wrong on this one, and others need to too. Stop making excuses. Stop desperately trying to find some dark corner where a crumb of justification may be scraped off the floor. Don't be an apologist. If you feel betrayed by the Lib Dems on tuition fees, or just plain appalled by tuition fees because you never trusted Clegg in the first place, stop being a sycophant. I'm very much aware that if this piece makes the edit, it will be heard on Friday the 17th of June, the first day of the BHA conference. I'm not sure Grayling's new College of the Humanities will do the BHA much good. An organisation promoting a moral and ethical framework for society with Grayling at the head may lose credibility. I know this piece will split the room. Good. Honest debate is needed. This is Misty for the Pod Delusion.
Now, Dr. T this week has been speaking to a rather famous economist, writer and radio presenter. You could say that his report will be more or less good. Here's Dr. T with more.
For the last week or so, undercover economist Tim Harford has been promoting his new book, Adapt, via a series of 10 lectures covering some of the topics in the book. The book is currently out on hardback and, as Amazon knows, I'm a paperback person, and so I haven't quite got round to reading it. Despite this, I caught up with him in Oxford to discuss his book and lecture, and what follows is an edited version. The full interview can be found in the Poddelusion Extra for them that wants. Okay, I'm talking to Tim Harford, the undercover economist, and writes for the Financial Times, and is also presenter of BBC Radio 4's More or Less programme. Tim has a new book out called Adapt, dealing with concept of learning from mistakes. Is that right?
That is right. But if it was wrong, the subtitle is Why Success Always Starts with Failure. So if we began the whole interview with an error, that would have been just fine. It would have promised great things.
I'm more than happy to learn from my mistakes, which from what I understand, is the driving force behind the book.
That is sort of the driving force behind the book, and of course we all say we're happy to learn from our mistakes, but psychological evidence suggests we have a slightly more dysfunctional relationship with our failures. So I'm happy to talk about that in a moment, but I guess zooming back and looking at the big picture of the book, it started off as a book about how complex problems get solved, and I wanted to write about how economics can help fix climate change and how to prevent the banks from melting down again and all this sort of thing, all the big problems we face. And I went on to look at the war in Iraq, I looked at innovation, I looked at development, which is what we're here sitting in the corner of a lecture theatre in Oxford. I'm talking about development problems in about 20 minutes. And the more I looked at all of these problems, the more I came to the central conclusion, which is they're just too hard. So too many incentives involved, there are too many products involved, there are too many people involved. We don't really understand these systems. But what does work as a problem-solving technique is trial and error. It's incredibly powerful, whether you're talking about biological evolution, or you're talking about the evolution of firms in a market, or whether you're talking about the scientific method, which is another selection mechanism for getting rid of bad ideas and replacing them with good ideas. However you do it, trial and error is very, very powerful. And so that is what the book ended up being about, the power of trial and error, and also our reluctance to embrace institutions that are good at trial and error, and our reluctance in our personal lives to experiment and to learn from our mistakes, for all the fact that we keep paying lip service to the idea.
Are we watching a failure being played out with the NHS reforms?
So I'm no expert at all on what's going on, because it's all kind of wonkish and quite boring, and there's lots and lots of detail. And I think that's part of Andrew Lansley's problem, is that he's not very good at explaining what it is that he's trying to do. So it may be sensible, it may be disastrous, but I haven't got a clue. So let me not overrate my ability to pronounce on this. I have a lot of time for experiments with our existing institutions. I don't have a problem with taking something that, well, maybe works pretty well, but maybe could work better, and making some changes. I have a big problem with the idea that you can do this in one big bang. Now, I know that conservatives have this idea that they're quite pro-pluralism, pro-localism, seem to be pro-experimentation. In a way, that supports the thesis of the book. I mean, the book is all about experimentation. You've got to try lots and lots of different things. You have to adapt to local conditions. So I feel like I should be sympathetic to that conservative agenda. And the reason I'm not is two things. One is they seem to want to move very, very fast, and that doesn't usually work. You need to experiment slowly. You need pilots. You need to sort of figure out what's working, what's not. And the second is, I don't see a huge interest in sort of rigorous evaluations. It seems to be the view that if only we localise, obviously that will work. And in the book, I talk about a lot of policy experiments where, and localism often is incredibly powerful. I mean, I often bang the drum for localism in anywhere from the way the US Army conducted itself in Iraq, where they didn't give enough authority to more junior officers. When they did, things started to turn around. Anywhere from that to how Whole Foods, an American supermarket, organises its human resources policy. I mean, localism often works. It doesn't always work. And when I look at the policy evidence, for instance, on, say, fighting corruption in development aid, which is something I'm going to be talking about in this lecture in Oxford, sometimes localism works and sometimes a central audit works. I mean, you can't simply prescribe without evidence. that a certain approach is going to work. So you need the evaluations. And so while I'm sympathetic to this idea of localism, and I worry that they're not really going to bother to collect the evidence to show that it works. And that's very common with politicians. We as voters, we don't really like our politicians experimenting, and so we don't vote for politicians who experiment, we vote for politicians who seem rather confident and who already know the answer.
Is that a problem with our own political system that we can't do anything about, where we want politicians to experiment and to get the evidence and to find out what's going to happen? But if we have a politician who changes his mind, it's seen as being weak and flip-floppish, it's played out in the media as a backpedaler.
Yeah, I think that's really lazy journalism, because of course if you can't be bothered to figure out the facts, you can't be bothered to dig through the evidence. One thing you can say is, well, this guy said one thing last week and now he's saying something different. That's really easy to criticise somebody, because We don't know whether he's right now or whether he was right before. At least we know he's contradicting himself. So a U-turn makes for an easy story. But, you know, it's not just the media, it's the voters. I mean, we don't like U-turns. Remember Margaret Thatcher, U-turn if you want to, the lady's not for turning. Mm-hmm. Tony Blair, I don't have a reverse gear. I mean, we voted for those people in for six general elections, cumulatively. I mean, I know it's, you know, first past the post and blah, 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 but basically they were tremendously successful. You wouldn't buy a car that didn't turn and didn't reverse. But in a politician, we seem to find these quite attractive attributes. And okay. I just don't think we should. I think we're much more willing to reward politicians who say, well, we don't know, we're going to try and find out.
I know time's pressing on, and we haven't actually talked too much about what you're actually talking about tonight. Yeah. So maybe you could give a brief presse of the main points. You're talking about development. Do we know the difference between success and failure?
Sure. So I'm talking about development, and in particular development aid in very poor countries. And building on the central insight of the book, which is that trial and error is very important in a complex world. We're not going to get things right first time. I'm really talking about the error correction mechanisms in development aid and the ways that we can evaluate what's working and what's not, fix problematic policies and replace them with better policies. So I'm talking about three examples of that. One, I'm going to spend quite a lot of time on the use of randomized controlled trials in development. We're all familiar with the idea of a randomized controlled trial in pharmaceuticals, but you can do it in education policy, yeah, you can do it in anti-corruption. I mean, you can do these things. So I'll talk about that, and I'll talk about how they caught on in medicine, because it was a very long and painful process in medicine. So the second thing I'm going to talk about is generally transparency and feedback in the aid industry. And the third thing is it possible to create spaces where you can conduct policy experiments as a national government, where a national government can conduct policy experiments on a big enough scale to make a difference, but not such a big scale as to be vulnerable to these huge catastrophic failures. And there's one pretty wacky idea that probably won't work, but I think is worth a try. So I'm going to be talking about that as well.
Okay. Well, hopefully at a later date we'll be able to get you back and find out what that was. Well, not spoil it for the people that are going to be here tonight. There's a new series of More or Less coming out in the autumn.
It is coming out in August.
Hey, coming out in August,
okay.
Is
More or Less in August. The website, of course, is bbc.co.uk/more or less. We have a podcast. Please subscribe, everybody, and you won't miss the first programme.
I think the Venn diagram of the overlap of Pod Delusion listeners and More or Less listeners is a big overlap.
Well, people of taste. People of taste.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Tim Harford, the Undercover Economist, thank you very much indeed.
Now, I imagine the overlap between Pod Delusion listeners and Daily Express readers is quite small, but if you have been reading the Express this week, presumably in your fortress in the village of Midsummer, you'll know that they made some selective truths about recent immigration statistics. To find out more, here's Tom Hodden.
Hello there. Some of you may notice that Eurostat, the statistical arm of the EU, has been releasing some figures recently about the number of new citizens who received passports for member nations of the EU. And, as a member nation of the EU, that included figures for how many new people got British passports in the year 2009. Over on the website for that not-at-all-scary institution, the Daily Express, Tom Morgan went to town with the story. The story is dated Saturday, June 11th, if you want to go and look it up yourself. The crux of the concern is that 204,000 people received brand spanking new British passports. Critics, though curiously Tom Morgan forgets to tell us who these critics are, have apparently claimed this will push our public services to breaking point. It is only later in his article that Morgan finds room to have a critic he can actually attribute some quotes to, Gerard Batten, Home Affairs spokesman for that completely unbiased and impartial group, UKIP. Batten is quick to tell us that it's the fault of Labour, whose last government let all these astonishing figures happen, and that David Cameron has to get a grip and introduce radical policies to halt immigration. What an astonishing surprise! The UKIP spokesman thinks that the government should adopt UKIP policy. He doesn't reference the claim that anything is near breaking point, and nowhere in the article does it concern itself with explaining exactly which public services are going to be strained by these particular immigrants. Many noted that despite the figures being for people receiving new passports, the denouncement at the end of the article is about David Cameron cutting back on student and work visas. So that is dealing with the issue of passports by cutting back on temporary visas. Nice! Now my sceptical nerves got jangled when I read this story, and even before I reached the end of the article I was hitting Google. I wanted some context to these figures, to try and work out if they are astonishing and worrying as the anonymous critics claimed. Let's dig out a pen and paper and see what we can deduce with some pretty simple mathematics. First of all, let's address the most shocking figure, that the number of new passports was 50% higher than the 2008 number. This seems to be correct, although the way the Express described it, with the figures being 50% higher than those ushered in for 2008, was a little deceitful. As the Express themselves recognised, the main cause of this jump was the much-debated virtual amnesty. Given the limitations of the figures the Express uses, and the very nature of the amnesty, we cannot say for sure that a single person was ushered anywhere. The amnesty was for files that had already accumulated. The figure, that 204,000, is for people who received new passports. It is entirely possible that they had been in the country for any amount of time before 2009. I have another contention that cannot be entirely blamed on the Express. We can tell from their article that the number has increased by 57% compared to the previous year's figures, but how does that compare to the population overall? Surely, if it is pushing our public services to breaking point, we must be facing a migration of epic proportions. So let's take a look. According to the Office of National Statistics, the population of the UK in 2009, when these astonishing numbers of people became citizens, was 61,792,000. I'll let that sink in. 61.7 million. For 204,000, that is breaking our public services, account for less than 0.33% of the population. 1/3 of 1%. Suddenly the number doesn't look so big. Exactly what services are these new citizens breaking? Well, let's anticipate the usual right-wing stereotype. More often than not, when we discuss immigration, it is only a matter of time before some smart aleck tells us that these foreigners are coming to the UK because we are a soft touch of benefits and foreign johnnies are jobless sponges. Well, let's hit Google again. In December 2009, The Telegraph put a story up on their website about a fall in claims of job seekers' allowance that month, the first drop since February 2008. The total number of unemployed in the UK climbed by 21,000 in the 3 months up to October 2009, a smaller rise than predicted. Checking over at the Office of National Statistics website, we can see a handy graph which shows the rise and fall of unemployment figures across each quarter. There was a sharp rise in January 2010, but there is no correlation between this and the immigration figures. In fact, the graphs which show the unemployment rate as a percentage of the entire economically active population has a sampling variability of 0.3%. So the astonishing number of new citizens is only the same percentage of the population as the margin for error used to chart the unemployment figures. Is the Express truly expecting us to believe that what is now seeming like a pretty small number is going to break public services? Aren't there more pressing concerns which might have a much bigger impact? Something like pulling a random example out of my arse. The recession? Personally, I think the public services are a much bigger problem to deal with than an extra 0.33% on the total population. For example, hitting Google once more, I found headlines suggesting that the NHS may lose up to 5,000 staff, police budgets are set to be slashed by 20%, and the McNaughty report wanting 30% efficiency savings on the railway, any one of which is far more likely to break the relevant service than the increase in immigration. I happen to think those may be a bigger strain than a group the same size as the population of Aberdeen. From the Moral High Ground, this has been Tom Hodden for the Pod Delusion.
Back in episode 85, we had an amazing report on the oncoming rapture, including an interview with someone who believed that rapture was imminent. It turns out, though, as because you're listening to this now, this wasn't quite the case. So there's now allegations being made that the man behind it, I mean Harold Camping, not Jesus, was willfully deceiving his supporters, and this could put him into some hot water. I guess the easiest way for him to prove his innocence would be to get Jesus to turn this hot water into wine. Salim Fadley has been speaking to the Freedom From Religion Foundation, who are calling for an investigation to find out more.
For the past 5 years, radio evangelist Harold Camping has been predicting that the Christian rapture would occur on May the 21st, 2011. His vision of an apocalyptic future literally put the fear of God into thousands of his followers, who gave up their wealth and time in order to help warn the world of the impending doomsday. Conventional wisdom is that Camping is merely a deluded old fool who grew overconfident in his ability to extract hidden truths from the Bible. But what of the suffering caused by his preposterous prophecies? What of the personal responsibility he and his organization share in bankrupting families and terrorizing his credulous followers into committing criminal acts? I spoke with Kirsten Fox of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Kirsten recently helped draft a letter to the District Attorney of California requesting that the state investigate Howard Camping's group. I asked Kirsten to begin by explaining why the Freedom From Religion Foundation suspects that Family Radio, that's Howard Camping's group, may have acted dishonestly.
So California's civil code for deceit requires that the court finds that Camping and his organization willfully deceived others with the intent that their position be worsened, in this case by giving him their money, meaning he had to convince people that something was true, although he himself did not believe it to be true. So in his radio broadcast, he really often does seem outwardly sincere in his beliefs, but there's some interesting actions that have come to light since all of the media reports that seem to suggest he didn't believe the rapture was set to occur anytime soon, or at the very least not before November 15th of this year. For example, his organization apparently requested a tax filing and extension in at least one state where he would have until mid-November to file his taxes. But the thing is, the original filing date was July 15th, which was 55 days after the world was supposed to end, according to his prophecies. So there's also the fact that his employees at his organization largely planned to go about their normal routine. They were making the same production schedules, planning to show up for work, making engagements, exactly as they had up until that point.
I suppose sincerity isn't a binary thing. He claimed to be 100% certain that the rapture would occur on the 21st of May. He might have had some doubts, or maybe quite a lot of doubts, in the confidence of his own predictions.
That's very important, whether there's doubt or not. Had his followers known that he had doubts about it, maybe it would have influenced some of them before they gave him their money.
That sounds like a fraud. However, in your letter to the district attorney, you also identify what might amount to a violation of the code which regulates Californian charitable trusts. Obviously, it would take a full audit of his accounts to prove guilt. Do you have any reasonable grounds to suspect that he might have violated the Californian charity laws?
The call for an investigation is asking the California Attorney General to comb through his organization's records with a much finer tooth comb than we're able to do as just members of the general public. Family Station's publicly available tax returns for the last several years already raise some questions, though. For example, according to the documents and his own statements, Camping has never formally drawn a salary, but logically, he has to have certain living expenses. So an audit can help ensure that the tax filings accurately reflect what, if any, salary Camping is receiving from these donations. One factor, though, that may help these rapture victims is the fact that California has very stringent regulations pertaining to charities and other nonprofits with substantial revenues, like Family Stations. Camping is the formal and the informal head of the business, and his position vests him with various legal and fiduciary duties to the organization's members, meaning he has a responsibility to act to them in a manner that's consistent not only with the business's stated guidelines, but the regulations of nonprofits generally. So if he was indeed deceitful or fraudulent in his solicitation of the money and then blew the contributor's life savings in many cases in improper ways, he may have violated certain state California provisions. So it may turn out that all the contributions were really used in a legal manner, but the fact is we have no way of knowing this until these limited records are released in November. The California Attorney General, on the other hand, can jumpstart the process, and hopefully she can help some of these victims seek closure if she deems that it's appropriate.
Speaking of Camping's followers, it's clear that these people have been gravely abused. He frightened them into giving up their money and their time for his own madcap purposes. But is that substantially different from any religion? Surely he's protected by the same parts of the US Constitution which protect other religions from being sued when they make madcap claims.
Well, Camping is largely free to make any personal statements he wishes. He can spend every penny of his own personal money to advertise the supposed end times to whomever will listen. But when he acts as the head of his nonprofit company rather than as an individual citizen, he has different legal duties, and he's subjecting his speech and his actions to a different set of laws. In California, this will include the Civil Code, the State Business and Professions Code, and their other laws governing charitable organizations. So Camping got his message out through the organizations, internationally syndicated radio station, and through billboards with plugs for Family Station's website that were, in many cases, almost as large as the font used to promote the doomsday message. So this was not Camping the man talking about the rapture. This was Camping the head and voice of Family Stations Incorporated.
Although according to a statement made by Harold himself, he claimed that God was the CEO of Family Radio.
Well, if he could present God in court, he may have a claim.
That would settle so many arguments.
That should have happened years ago. Imagine where we'd be now.
The First Amendment provides religious organizations with a great deal of protection to solicit money for implausible purposes. But is that protection absolute? Are there examples where individuals have been able to sue religious organizations for making false claims?
It's not absolute, and I completely agree that religious organizations in general behave in very similar ways quite often, but we really don't see all that many court cases about it. And the reason why is what the courts call the entanglement doctrine. Basically, courts won't interfere in disputes between individuals and a religious organization if it would require that the court examines interpretations of the laws, the policies, the practices of any religion, church, or denomination. So, for instance, in the Hancock versus True and Living Church case, a Utah court refused to rule on an individual's claim that the church didn't provide numerous religious benefits, like spiritual favoritism and even a personal meeting with Jesus, as it had promised in exchange for large amounts of cash, naturally. So to do so would have violated the entanglement doctrine, and the court declined to get involved in church matters. But in Camping's case, the allegations are purely secular in nature. No one is asking a court to determine if the rapture is objectively true or false, because again, it's not a court's place to rule on private religious dogma. The legal question is whether Camping induced others to act to their own disadvantage based on purported facts that he knew to be untrue, whether he objectively committed deceit under California law. The actual religious content of those claims isn't really legally important.
Many Christian groups were keen to distance their beliefs from those of Harold Camping and his Family Radio cult. However, the claims he actually made were quite unremarkable when compared to other evangelical fundamentalist leaders. His zany belief in a physical rapture followed by a period of destructive tribulation, these are still common beliefs in America. The only thing that's different about Harold Camping was that he set a date. So will the FFRF and other groups that educate people about the dangers of religion be able to use this as an opportunity to educate people about the kinds of harm that religion can cause?
I've actually mentioned that to several other people, that the only difference in his crazy belief and the crazy beliefs of mainstream Christianity is his willingness to really commit and set a date. And I'm pretty sure I lost at least one Baptist friend because of that discussion. It's certainly our hope that drawing attention to the particularly egregious violations involving religion and the state will help people see these businesses for what they are, or at least get the ball rolling so people can start to question the sort of religious dogma that really otherwise tends to get this free pass in American society in ways that other speech just doesn't. The family radio case, though, is especially sad because it not only capitalized on people's fear of death, the unknown, and used these gruesome and sectarian means of doing so, but it also caused a lot of tangible harm. And these sorts of messages typically do on both individuals and society. So our letter cites numerous media reports of people who lost their entire life savings, abandoned their homes, abandoned their families. Even scarier, though, than the financial losses, there have been reports of suicides. And in California, a woman who slit her children's throats and then slit her own just to avoid camping's apocalypse fairy tale. So if we can get people to start thinking about that, how dangerous that religious propaganda is, perhaps others will start to question the harm caused by other types of religious proselytizing. At the very least, though, religious organizations must be held to the same legal standards as secular society, and that's what we hope to accomplish here.
When we spoke with Dr. John Wallace in episode 85, he predicted that Harold Camping would excuse his failed prediction of calamity by claiming that it did in fact happen, but in some kind of spiritual sense. Fortunately for us, Dr. John Wallace's prophecy came absolutely true. Camping, on the other hand, has backpedaled from his original prediction and set a new date for the world to end. It's now October the 21st, 2011. In a recent statement, Camping confirmed that he does not intend to return any of the funds which were originally raised on the expectation of a May the 21st judgment day. This is Salim Fadley for The Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, a quick check-in with James Thomas, who you may remember last week revealed that he's currently participating in an experiment to see the effects of not washing for 40 days. We thought we ought to check in on him, to mostly check he's not killed over with some sort of horrible disease, but also out of morbid curiosity. Luckily, he sent this report in via email. If you're eating, I'd pause the podcast now until you've finished. Seriously.
Smelly Tweet, A Personal Diary, Part 2. I'd like to open this report with a quote from Nietzsche. Does wisdom perhaps appear on the earth as a raven which is inspired by the smell of carrion? As I record this, it is day 26 of Smelly Tweet, and matters have migrated from the ridiculous to the sublime to what can only be described as the phantasmagorical. As promised, and apart from my hands, I have not cleaned or attempted to clean any other part of my body, and, dear listeners, it is really starting to show. The all-over body itch is constant. The lumps of dead skin that have adhered to my scalp are tremendously satisfying to gouge away, even if they are leaving my hair populated with more dandruff than drunk Uncle Bobby, and the tops of my legs and gluteal cleft are... Well, this is a family show, so I need to be careful how I describe this, but I think you will all know what I mean when I say that they are more crimson than Tony Benn's heart and claim an odour not too dissimilar to durian fruit, which, if you have not encountered, is wonderfully evoked by the food writer Richard Sterling as the odour is best described as pig shit, turpentine and onions garnished with a gym sock. Now, if you will forgive me, I will refrain from talking about the biblical amounts of smegma I seem to be generating, but I am happy to report that I've been contacted by a very enterprising group of Mongolian yak herders who seem to be very chirpy about the possibilities of gaining an export certificate from DEFRA. In more positive news, I have been offered a job with the British Science Association, which I immediately accepted before they had a chance to change their minds, and which means that Smelly Tweet looks as though it may continue for at least another week. And so, until next week, I leave you with another quote from Penn Jillette, which I hope you will find a little more reassuring than Freddy Boy. My favourite thing about the internet is that you get to go into the private world of some real creeps without having to smell them. This has been James, beyond Stinky Thomas, for the Pod Delusion.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen in full to Liz's full interview about the old-timey fossils. And also tune into the Pod Delusion extra feed, where you can listen to a discussion recorded last week with Richard Dawkins and PZ Myers. And also to Science in the Pub, a new event down in South London, which discusses science whilst in the pub. That's the gist of it. But also on our website, you can listen back to older episodes and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, buy badges and merch and all that sort of thing. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Christine Ottery, James Firth, Misty, Dr. T, Tom Hodden, Salim Fadby, James Thomas, and me, James O'Malley. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. In a moment, you're going to hear a short song by David Lovesey. This one goes out to James Longstaff, who told me in the pub the other day he's having trouble understanding genetics. Thanks for listening.
Son, you look troubled.
Well, yes, Father. It's this homework we've been given. It's all about genetics, and I don't understand any of it.
Oh, that's easy, son. Let me show you what my father taught me.
Young lads, you need to copy yourself. I said, young lads, you want to slowly evolve, I said, young life. You've got more for the gene to come. Digitize those records your body expresses genes through protein. Cells can do this by joining amino acids, but the knowledge of the way they go in has to come from somewhere, somehow. We've got to talk about your I'm talking about your DNA.
Thank you, Father. Who are your friends? And why are you dressed as a Native American?